Good afternoon. So, last time, we talked about how x86-64 assembly actually is encoded. We're doing this because we're going to deal with things that manipulate machine code. And you mentioned that, well, it's a lot more complicated than it seems like it really should be, and this is a lot because of the history, that it was built from 16-bit going to 32-bit, going to 64-bit, and they kind of added on without trying to change too much each time, which means that we have sort of a lot of extra steps, and also the 16-bit encoding was trying to be really compact, so they do things like stuffing a whole bunch of different values into one byte. And the basic encoding we had is we had a bunch of possible prefixes followed by opcode, which could be more than one byte. And if we had register arguments, we typically had this mod RM byte, which would contain this mod field and an RM field for a memory operand and a register number for a non-memory operand. And sometimes, because x86 supports this base index scale addressing, we have this extra SIB, scale index base byte. And after that, we might have, as you'd expect, constants from the instruction encoded. And notable for this 64-bit part is that we had this rex prefix, this thing we added before instructions, to encode the extra registers, namely R8 through R15, and also to make the 64-bit versions of what would otherwise be 32-bit instructions. We also mentioned sort of a parallel issue, so all this was mostly about how do we encode register numbers and so on, that when we have addresses to encode, we can represent them as sort of a relative to the current instruction. So RIP, which is, current instruction plus offset, that relative encoding, or an absolute, which is, sort of the exact final value, not relative to the current instruction. And we saw that x86 kind of does both of these, depending on which instruction you're using. You have to, look at it. And this is a consideration which comes up in things like malware, because malware often is manipulating machine code. And in particular, we started by looking at viruses, which went to sort of add machine code to an existing executable. And they need to be concerned about, well, can I just put this anywhere or not? And that depends on whether your addresses are encoded relatively or absolute. And on that vein, we started looking at a very simple example of a very old virus for DOS known as Vienna. And we saw that sort of the way it worked is that it infected it. Added itself to existing executable files in this very simple COM executable format. And it did this by appending its code to the end of the executable and adding a jump at the beginning to point to that code. So we have our executable, and when Vienna infected it, it added its code at the end and replaced a jump here. And it still wanted the normal executable to run, so it made a backup copy of what was originally at that jump, and it restored that before jumping back to the beginning after it ran. And we saw that it went through these convolutions. We'll look at more of these. That to make this work. So one thing it needed to do is it needed to, at the end of this, it needed to jump back. And the way they did that is that the author of Vienna decided to do push then return to do that jump because they had this absolute versus relative problem. This push return is kind of a way of getting an absolute jump version of what would be a of jump of the sort of a jump, which would be a relative encoding if it was actually encoded as just a normal jump. Okay. Some questions about the things we covered last time.
I'm just generally curious. Just what was the point of the jumping back to the beginning of the code for the Vienna case study?
So why is it jumping back?
Yeah, like because you already did the payload, right? Like, you already go the code already jumps to the bad code essentially. Why does it jump right back to the code that was already there before?
So the idea is that this would be some executable you wanted to run, like word.com. And the idea is you'd run Word, it would run the virus, and then it would run the original version of Word. So part of what the goal of this virus was to make sure that it looked like the original executable, even though it was doing something malicious. And jumping back to run the original code is how it did that. But that's an important consideration, and something we should think about is that a lot of malware is going to be taking a whole bunch of steps to be stealthy. And the most important consideration is you kind of want to be stealthy to normal users. So there's a question, what makes a regular jump relative and this return sequence not? So note when I'm saying that this sequence is equivalent to this regular jump. But the machine code for this is going to be something like an opcode for push. So it's going to be push opcode 0001, the bytes of this address, and then the ret opcode. That's how this is going to be encoded, the way Vienna uses it. If we did a jump, this would be encoded as jump opcode and the current address minus one. So this value here would depend on where in the executable it was. So encoding this jump, you'd have something, it would be different if it was here versus here, for example, because you have to encode the distance, how many instructions it is to address 100. So that's why, so this ends up being absolute because we can just put the 100, in this case, little endian, in the push instruction. Here, we can't just push the 100 in the jump instruction. We have to compute the distance because that's how the jumps work on x86, because that's usually more convenient, and that's what the x86 designers chose. Then there's a question of, for our encoding here, what's a situation in which we'd have, in which the SIB bit and the rex prefix would need to be set? So the rex prefix, we need to talk about that it has these bits. So the rex prefix had this, I forget what the name is, it had a W bit for is 64 bit, and it had these three extra bits for, the top bit of register numbers. And there were four places we can have register numbers. So this is a register number. This can be a register number, depending on what mod is, and when the SIB byte isn't used, we have two register numbers in there, one for the index register, one for the base register. And these are all three bits. So if, for example, we wanted to encode R13, R14, like move R13, R14 to, say, RAX, we need to have the register number 13 and 14 encoded. And 13 is 10, not 1101 in hex, and 14 would be 1110. And the way these would be encoded is that we'd put these two parts in the different parts of the SIB byte, these three bits, because that's what we needed on 32-bit, and we put this extra ones in the rex prefix. So hopefully that answers that question. So these three bits of the rex prefix that are extra bits for register numbers are for the cases where we're using these R8 through R15, and which one we set depends on which of these four places we could put register numbers are being used, and which one we went that extra top bit for. So, and there's a comment that as far as Vienna using this strategy, you think there weren't absolute jumps in the ISA at the time? I believe that was probably true. At least not absolute jumps that don't do something like probably you have to do like jump something, you know, some pointer or something. Like, so something less direct. So your question is that which of these refers to index and base? I believe I don't have my rec slide handy, but one of these bits corresponds to the index part, and the other is going to correspond, I believe, to the base part or the RM part. Because you'll never use an SIB byte and the RM part of the model RM byte. So question, why would the offset matter if Vienna was writing and compiling C code? So Vienna wasn't. So the Vienna virus and most sort of early viruses were written in assembly. And a lot of viruses have a lot of stuff written in assembly or direct fiddling with machine code because you have to manipulate machine code as part of that. So most likely Vienna was written in assembly. But there's a question, isn't the assembly always 0x100? So Vienna was written in assembly, but what Vienna does is, as part of running, is it copies the machine code that was generated by that assembly. Because, remember, Vienna is copying something to the end of an executable. And the assembler can generate that machine code for you, and that's probably what the Vienna author did. But when you're doing that, you have to make some special cases for things that aren't going to work when you copy that machine code to a different part of the executable. And if you just wrote jump 0x100, well, in assembly, that works anywhere in your assembly file, but the machine code the assembler generates is going to be different depending on where it is. And Vienna needed to compensate for that. Other questions before we pick up looking at more things with how Vienna deals with this code being here. So we saw sort of one thing Vienna needed to deal with is that, you know, they wrote some assembly code. They needed to work despite being down here, which meant they couldn't use their normal jump instruction without doing something extra. So their solution was that they would do this push and return. It turns out they had some other cases where that was a problem. So So one thing Vienna needed is it needed to access data. And a lot of the instructions it would normally use to access the data, you know, if you're writing normal assembly, you'd have instructions which encoded that address as an absolute address, but it moves around. So Vienna's solution to this is that they set the SI register to a base address for all the virus's data, and when they needed to access something, they would do some sequence that like took that base address and subtracted something from it or added something to it, and then use that location. And they wrote some code that when Vienna was infecting a new file, which is something it does, it's self-replicating, it would edit this number here. And the way it could do that is that the author of Vienna knew that this was a move that would be encoded with an opcode and then 2 bytes, which are the value to move into SI. And Vienna wrote some careful code, which is actually this code I used for an example here, where as it was infecting something, it would update this constant here with the location for the new file it was infecting. So when Vienna runs, it infects other files. It adds itself to other files. And the code for doing that, it would compute the length of the file. It would figure out, you know, what the location of the data would be when appending to that new file by adding this constant that tells how big the appended stuff would be. And then it would update in the machine code it was about to copy this value about where in memory this is going to end up loaded. And the way they did this, rather than making a new copy of the machine code in memory and then writing that to the file they were infecting, Vienna's code just updates the original, which is the thing that's running in memory right now, then writes that out, then updates it for the next file, writes it out, and so on. So after we do this update, it copies the current machine code plus update to the end of the newly infected file. So what Vienna is doing overall here is that we have this code that's at the end of the executable. When it runs, it scans for files to infect, and then, when it finds one, we have another file, and it might be a different size, and it's going to add the jump at the beginning of that file and make a new backup copy of what was originally there, and it's going to also copy the code from its original file to the new file with this small change to support the location of it changing because it's in a different spot when that executable runs. And there's a question I wrote here, describing what this code does. So here's this is updating that location. And it says, then copy the current machine code plus update. I mean, so we're copying the machine code, including this update, and just being explicit, to the end of the newly infected file. That's sort of the code that's missing here. So something that's a bit strange about how Vienna works, which is typical for viruses at this time, is that it edits the actual code for the move that's part of the virus. The virus is modifying its own code you might say, wait a moment, you know, we set this move up, we changed this move to be for the, you know, the new executable location, the one with the file we're infecting. Why doesn't this break things? And the big reason is that Vienna is depending on that we've already run this earlier, and now we're in the infecting code, but SI is set to the old value. You know, so unlike, you know, typical code you would write, Vienna's modifying itself because, well, it's only going to get run once each time the program is loaded. And editing the code, you know, will not change the file on disk. And, you know, code will be reloaded from disk the next time the original program is run. The original infected program is run. And Vienna already depends on this and how it deals with that jump at the beginning. It edits the jump to contain what was originally there and then goes back to the beginning so it can run the original executable, but that doesn't change the executable on disk. That executable on disk still has a copy of the virus in it that will start immediately. It just updated the copy in memory so we can run the executable as usual after run. And the other thing that Vienna needs to worry about relocating, so we saw changing this move instruction here. The other thing is that it needs to write that jump at the beginning. And it's actually a jump instruction. So Vienna could have chosen to insert a push return at the beginning, but they didn't. So Vienna actually does compute a jump instruction. And sort of the way it does it is it has a template here. So this is a jump to some address, and it computes based on the new file it's infecting. It computes, oh, we're going to jump to this address based on, you know, our file length, and it just updates the value with the, well, offset. So actually it subtracts, not to compute the offset of the jump, and copies that into the jump instruction here. And then it does this is basically equivalent to an fwrite to write that to the beginning of the executable it's infecting. So if you're thinking about the process that whoever wrote Vienna went through, is probably they wrote most of this in assembly, and then they realized that they needed to do some stuff to make it work, despite it being at different places in different executables, and they decided, well, I'll have this base pointer that I'll update, and oh, I also need to handle the jump at the beginning, and they did those sort of that logic by hand, and dealt with figuring out, oh, this is what the machine code looks like, because they, you know, had documentation for how, at the time, 16-bit x86 worked. So questions on the sort of relocation activity? So, something I think is interesting to note is that, you know, is that it seems like, well, you know, they had to deal with not having this base address because you have to use instructions that use absolute pointers somewhere. You can't really compute the address in 16-bit x86, but you can. So, Vienna could have done a strategy like this. So the assembly that would, this is disassembly, the assembly that would generate it would be something like this for 16-bit, is that you could call something, and the call instruction is encoded relatively. So in this case, a call to the next instruction is 0 bytes away. So it gets encoded as E8. This is the opcode for call. Call and an offset of 0. And the call pushes the address of this next instruction on the stack. And you can pop that. And then you can just compute things, you know, say, oh, I know I have a constant 13 bytes after CX, which is exactly what Vienna, you know, kind of does, except it computes its SI the same and with the same sort of usage. You know, it has a value which is a pointer to a known location that it uses to access values, but it leaves it as a constant and manually updates it when it infects new files. But they didn't actually have to do that. They could have avoided it. Why they didn't, I don't know. Like, I guess the author didn't realize that this was an option. I knew this was an option because this is commonly used by compilers which want to generate, like, library code that needs to work in multiple locations in 32-bit x86. So there's a question, you know, why was Vienna using the SI register? I don't know why they would have chosen that register. Presumably, it's more convenient for those instructions which only work with one register. But I'm not very familiar with what those restrictions were for 16-bit x86. I'm not that old, believe it or not. Okay, so we've seen Vienna's infection code here. We've seen that it has to do this fix-up, so someone went through the work of figuring out where exactly it needs to tweak its bits of machine code to make them work at different locations. You know, they couldn't just write something in assembly and copy the machine code and expect it to work everywhere. But there's another issue here. So it's appending code to infected applications, and it's a virus which is designed to spread to all the applications it can find. So it does something where it, like, looks at a bunch of directories and looks for COM files, executables in the format it understands, and appends itself to them after making the changes so it will work in its new location. But there's a problem with doing this, which is that, well, if you append itself each time, you'll make the files longer and longer. And eventually, someone's going to notice that they're out of space on their floppy. Probably not very long, given the size, you know, given that at this time you'd have like an 800K floppy. Or, you know, a couple megabyte hard drive, maybe. That's something that it needs to avoid. And this is actually a very common pattern we see in viruses, is that, well, you need to avoid reinfection, that you don't want to spread multiple copies of yourself, or else it will go out of control and you won't actually infect very far. And another issue with this is that when Vienna's infecting other files, this is not actually particularly fast. You need to write stuff to a bunch of files, especially when we're talking about the days of floppies being common. This is not going to be very efficient. So you'd like to avoid doing a lot of work in order to figure out, oh, I shouldn't infect this. So Vienna would scan through the Active Directories for executables, and it would have this way of marking the executables in the metadata, meaning that it wouldn't even have to read the code of the executables to, like, look for itself, because, you know, that's an option, but that would be really slow. And it's trying to be stealthy, if it turned out that every time you started your word processor, it took an extra 30 seconds, you might start to get suspicious. So sort of a goal was to avoid that. And Vienna author had this clever trick where they realized how metadata about files was kept track of in Windows and DOS. So the DOS file system at the time used, kept track of a last written time for files, the last modification time. And it used 2 16-bit numbers for this that it would store on the floppy or the disk. So one number for the date and one number for the time. And if you're used to modern Unix, you're probably used to having a number of seconds since a certain base time, and then you need to call some function that computes an actual human readable time from that. This is not how DOS stored dates. Instead, DOS decided that it would store the year, the month, the day, the hour, the minute, and the second, as separate fields, subsets of these 16-bit numbers. So they decided that they'd have 6 bits for the year, which they would store as an offset from 1980. If you needed to go more than 2 to the 6 years after 1980, well, that's too bad. They'd store the month as a 4-bit number. So this can store 0 through 15. Presumably, you wouldn't use all the possible values. And the day, similarly, they store as a 5-bit number. So this can store 0 through 32. They wouldn't use all the possible values. And the hour, we have a 4-bit number. The minute, we have a 6-bit number. And for the second, we have a 5-bit number. And, we have a problem here. So for the hours, 4-bit number, that's 0 through 16. Minute, 6-bit number, that's 0 through 64. For the second, this would be 0 through 31. So the solution that DOS had is they said, people don't really care about the exact second. So we're going to store 0 through 31 here, but have that correspond to 0 to 62 seconds. We're just going to double it when we actually display it and, divide by 2 when we store it. And most people aren't going to notice if, the number of seconds is off by a little bit, so they figured it didn't matter. And Vienna said, it doesn't matter. So this is a good place to store information I want. And so Vienna would set this to 31, making it so the file was modified, apparently, 62 seconds after the second, after the minute. And when looking for files to infect, it would skip over any executables that were marked as, this was modified 62 seconds after the minute, because it knew probably that meant I already infected it, even though maybe technically someone could have done that, but it seems impossible. And this sort of had a double purpose, too, is that as part of being stealthy, Vienna wanted to also modify these times here to not change them from the original values, so someone listing the directory and looking at the modification times wouldn't find things were strange. Because while they probably wouldn't notice the second numbers being weird, they probably would notice if most things were modified in, 89, but one thing was modified in 1990 that shouldn't have been. So questions about this kind of trick? So question is, if users modify the executable somehow, would that trigger a reinfection? Yes. But presumably, you know, well, I mean, that makes sense, because if you think about it, probably if they're modifying the executable, they're like replacing it with a version which probably isn't infected, at least not with Vienna. Other questions? So the question is, isn't this not very stealthy? So yeah, Vienna has sort of a common pattern of these early viruses in that it's not well hidden if you know what you're looking for. It's meant to avoid casual accidental detection, but it's not actually very stealthy if you know what you're looking for. And if we're thinking about making like software that can find Vienna, it's pretty easy. Like, we have this special metadata marking that we can just search for like really fast, because it's for the same reason Vienna can use it really fast. And even if Vienna was modified, which there probably are actual versions which are modified in this way to not use some other way of determining whether a file is infected, there's this distinctive pattern of the code. Like, there's this big chunk of code we can look for that's Vienna, that's always at the end of the file. So that would actually be fairly easy to look for. And we'll have a future assignment, which is sort of the simple pattern matching approach of looking for it in that way. And something that sort of more sophisticated malware does is it, avoids this kind of detection. It doesn't give you an easy thing to look for, in the metadata of files, or if you're looking, for a particular chunk of machine code. So the question, is the metadata separate from the DOS exploit? I don't understand the question. So the DOS part here is that DOS is the operating system Vienna ran on, and this is how the files on DOS worked. This is how they stored modification times. Clarification, follow-up, or do I move on? Okay. So, Vienna does some things which, wouldn't work on future OS. It's very much very tied to DOS in a bunch of ways. So we have this sort of obvious way that it's relying on a particular quirk of how the DOS file system works to avoid reinfection. But sort of more fundamentally, part of why, it's as simple as it is and why I'm using it as our first example is that it relies on the COM executable format being really simple. You could just append stuff to it and it would end up in the executable. You just change something at the beginning to change what happened at the beginning. Modern executable formats aren't so simple. You just can't take a modern executable, change the beginning, and that's gonna put a jump there. That's not gonna work. You can't just append to them and expect that to work without making some other changes. It also relies on self-modifying code. The way it deals with making changes to the machine code to work at a different location is by editing its code and then copying the edited code. That strategy doesn't actually work on modern systems. If you try to edit your code, often you'll get a seg fault. Edit your machine code, you'll often get a seg fault, so you need to take some extra steps. So we're going to want to talk about things that you might do in less simple executable formats. So to do that, I need to talk about executable formats. So we're going to look, as an example for this class, at the ELF executable format, which is the one that Linux uses. So there's also the Windows executable format, the modern one, which is known as PE, for Portable Executable, which you might think means it's used by someone other than Windows, but it's not. And there's also the OS X executable format, which is something known as Mako. Those are all different. We're going to look at ELF because it's what's on Linux systems that we'll be using for assignments, not because it's better or worse than others. But most of the things we'll see in ELF are typical of all those other executable formats that you see on modern systems. And we think of running an executable, we typically have sort of our code, our constants, and also sort of writable data, by which I mean like global variables, etc., all loaded at some place in memory. And basically, the program that we load from disk is exactly what gets put in memory. So basically, this is part of the executable file, gets copied into memory, into this location, and as the program runs, some additional space is allocated to put the stack, to put things like the heap, that's things that are malloced or nude. But sort of this core stuff is copied from disk, similar to that COM format. But a modern executable file typically divides this into sections. So we'll have the code section, which is for historical reasons that I called the text segment of the executable. We'll have a separate part for data that's read-only and for data. And often we'll have a section which is stuff that is not actually loaded from disk, but just initialized to zeros for like global variables that start at zero. This will all be from the executable, but rather than just copying this whole thing from the file, typically each part will be loaded separately and they might have different permissions. This read-only data part will typically be set up so you can only read it, rather than with the COM file where you would be able to read and write everything. They'll actually be done independently. And this means that the executable on disk is going to have information about what are these pieces we need to load. Also, we have this part which is all zeros that's not actually stored in the executable file. How big is that? So we need some place to put that. So there's going to be this program header on disk that contains that information. So we're going to talk about the ELF format. So ELF stands for Executable and Linking Formats. It's most notably used by Linux. It's also very common among other Unix-like OSs. But it is not part of POSIX or anything like that. But it is something that a lot of Unix-like OSs have used. So it has a header at the beginning, which has sort of the very generic information, and then something that the ELF documentation calls a program header, which is most importantly a list of segments of the file to load. It also has some other information. We'll see some examples of that later. And basically, the way loading an ELF executable works is that first, the operating system is going to check this and make sure, is it for the right machine? Is it actually this type of executable? And then it's going to go through this list of things in the program header and copy things into memory according to the instructions here. So depending on what instructions are here, tells how much will be loaded, whether it's going to be readable or writable, and so on. And after this header will be the actual data to load. And there's often a bunch of additional data in an executable. So this is sort of, things, needed to actually run it, at least to load it. But we might have some additional data, and Most notable of this is that there's often a list of sections. So confusingly, ELF has something called segments and sections. Yes, they probably shouldn't do that. The important things are segments. Those are what's actually loaded. But there are these sections, which are mostly used by the linker when constructing executables, and also are very useful for things like the debugger. And this might include things like most debugging information and so on. So there's these sections, which appear in object files and usually executables for the linker. But the segments are what we actually use to load the program. And the program loader, you know, it just has these instructions. We'll see what they look like. They're not complicated. And that's what it does. And I'm going to show you a bunch of output from Object Dump, which is a tool on Linux for examining executable and object files. And if we take an executable file that doesn't have unnecessary information stripped out of it, you can find a list of sections. So as I said, this is information for the linker, which tells us about the different parts of stuff in the executable file. So you can see we have some notes, like a build ID to tell us when this was built. So like we can distinguish multiple executables built at different times, information about what version of the calling convention and so on this uses. We have these things here are related to dynamic linking. Well, we may talk about that a bunch later. We have stuff for, you know, constructors and the like. So this init section is where any things that act like a C++ constructor for a global variable would be run. We have our actual code and a bunch of other sections that are, you know, and some a selected set is that there's the text is the program code. We have data for writable data like global variables and constant and global variables, read-only data like constants. We have BSS is data that's initially zeroed. The name stands for block started by symbol. But it's just initially zero data that's not actually stored, but there's a section for it to indicate its size, constructors and instructors, stuff related to dynamic linking, stuff for like exception handling. So those are all different sections. But as I said, this is mostly for the linker. It's useful for figuring out what an executable does, which is something we'll often want to do. It's something that if you work with malware in the real world, you know, if this information is in there, if you can figure out which parts of stuff are code or, you know, read-only or data or normal data, that's going to be helpful for understanding that malware, but it's not actually used for loading the executable. So, talked about sections. Let's talk about the other parts of the executable, the parts that are actually used when loading it. And here I have an example of an executable on my Linux system, BusyBox. I'm using this example because it's statically linked, and we don't want to talk about dynamic linking yet. So just because it's a little simpler, turns out. So we can see that the headers indicate that it's an ELF file for 64-bit x86. And it has these flags, which indicate, most importantly, this execp indicates it's an executable. Okay. We have a start address. So in COM, the first instruction executed was the beginning of the executable. In ELF, this is the first instruction executed. So when the executable is loaded, this is where the OS jumps to. So then we have the program header and the section information. And we're going to look at the program header. We just looked at the sections, which are kind of our lay of what's in the executable file. The program header contains a list of instructions for loading it, most notably these ones labeled load. We'll look at the other types in a bit. So the load here, so this first load says to load this, I copied the wrong number. So I change this without changing this. So this says to load file size bytes. And it says to load it starting at this offset into the file. And to memory at this address. You might notice there's a vadder and padder. For what we're concerned about, these will always be the same. There's some cases that aren't relevant to this class where they would be different, where we might have control over physical addresses. This doesn't happen on any systems we're going to care about. So it says to load this many bytes from the executable. From the executable at this location into memory at this location. And we have a second load instruction which says to load from this offset in the executable into this address this many bytes is loaded, so the file size, but the mem size is bigger. So what that means is that the extra space that's in mem for the memory size is going to be filled with zeros. So this is used for global variables that are initially zero. And there's also these flags here. So this flags here says readable and executable. And this flags here says read and write, readable and writable. So questions on how these load operations work. So the question is, why does the file get to decide where it's put in memory? So the big reason why is that the machine code that the linker generated may assume that things are at certain locations in memory. It might use that absolute addressing. It might have like a move 0x61000REX or something like that, you know, which in an Intel syntax would be a move from, you know, a fixed address, which would be encoded using that actual address in machine code. So it needs to be loaded at a particular address to work. So that's the reason the executable format supports this, is that we can't just put all executables at arbitrary locations in memory and expect them to work. Often the machine code expects them to be loaded at a particular location. And that's going to have to be the OS's assumption when it sees an executable like this. Now, it is true that there are some executables, especially more recently, which can be loaded at other locations. So in that case, there's some metadata that's going to appear in this executable file we haven't talked about yet. And if that were the case, the OS would know that it can ignore this virtual address and choose something else. Is that... answer questions about why the file's deciding location. Okay. So these load operations in the program header are the most important thing for actually running the executable. If you look at a program header, you'll typically see a bunch of other stuff. So you'll see like a note, which is like a comment, like for debugging and figuring out how something was built. TLS is for thread local storage. So if you have stuff that needs to be kept separately for, you know, each thread, each core. The version of object dump that exists on our VM will output one thing without a name. So it turns out in the program header, they don't actually write note and load. They actually write a number that's assigned. And there's a number that object dump doesn't know its meaning, which is called GNU property, which is some additional info for the loader, which we may talk about much later when we talk about control flow integrity. There's this section for stack, and you might say, okay, so that says where the stack is. Well, it doesn't, because all these locations are zero, but it says whether the stack is writable. or says, you know, the stack is read and write and not executable. And a section rel ro says, oh, if we're using dynamic linking, it says to set something as read only. We'll talk about why that's important later. Okay. So we've seen sort of the load operations. Let's go through an example here. So here are a list of load instructions. And my first question is, based on this, how big is this executable on disk? How big is the file? So we have a list of when this program gets loaded, what gets copied into memory. Based on this, how big should the executable be? Like, if you look at the file size, what number would you most expect to see? And I'm saying about because it might be the case that there's stuff that's on disk that doesn't get, that isn't actually used when running the executable, or is loaded in some other way. And once you have the answer to one, you should think about two, which is that if this has a global array with an initial value, what's the largest size we'd expect it to have? Give another 20 seconds. Okay. So we have a bunch of answers and a minority have chosen what I think is the best answer. So I think the best answer is we look for the highest offset and we add the file size. So my answer would be BC0CC0 plus X170. And the reason why I'm saying that is that, well, we know that we're loading a section that starts at this location and goes to here. And this gives us a size that is 0xC398, and a bunch of you chose answers where what we did instead is we either added up all the file sizes here, or we added up all the mem sizes. So adding up all the mem sizes has the problem that, well, the difference between the file and mem size is just stuff that's filled with zeros that we don't store in the file. So it doesn't tell you how big it is on disk. But you might wonder, wait, why do when we add these sizes up, do we get a smaller number than the location? And what's happening is that the executable has these sections which are loaded, and there's a bit of space in between them. We'll talk about why that is next. But it turns out there's a bit of space, so the actual size, on disk is going to include that extra space. So questions about how I figured this out and about this extra space being there? Besides, we'll talk about exactly why it's there. Yes.
Yeah, so like just for the answer, like the actual answer, like what was the the reasoning as to why you just picked the last two instead?
So, but basically what I want to do is I know that this file at least goes to offset plus file size that's in the file and loaded. Make sense? Mm-hmm. So I just want the maximum of all the offset plus file sizes for each of these load operations.
Okay.
And you can, so technically these loads could overlap, but you can usually assume they don't, because it would be very weird for them to overlap. So I just look for the highest offset, assuming that would be where it started. And the question is, did I write this number wrong? Yes. I meant to write 2230, because that is, in fact, what you get by adding these and not by adding the mem size.
Wait, so Professor, which is the correct answer for the poll?
So C2230.
Okay.
Which is adding BC, this offset here, and this file size here. If you're adding this offset and this mem size, well, the difference between the file and mem size isn't part of the file on disk. And if you're just adding up these sizes, there's space in between each of the things which are loaded, which you aren't accounting for. Okay. So let's go to the second question, which is based on this. What is the largest size that we would expect based on this header? And what you want to think about is, where could this global variable be stored? So, I'm all over this. There's a question, why don't we just have one load call? So why, when we look at an executable, are you typically going to see something like this where we have these multiple loads? And the main reason is to load the different parts with different permissions. I'll give another 10 seconds. Okay, so I think a majority of people chose the best answer. So the thing you want to look for is that this is a global variable that needs to be writable. So the only place it can be put is this writable section here. And it has an initial value, so it's going to need to fit in 0x6170 bytes. So the size needs to be less than or equal to 0x6170 bytes divided by the size of an int, because it's the number of ints we have. So that's going to be about, you know, a little, you know, between OX100 and OX200 when we do the divide by the size of an int, which is 4 on x86-64. Or did I do that right? Yeah. And there's a question of why would we just combine, why weren't these two sections combined? This is just how the linker chose to lay things out. I'm not sure exactly what the reasoning for that is, but basically they decided to do something like put code, data, constants, data, or something like, or rather, sorry, that's not what I meant here. They decided to put some data, which is actually, you know, program header, constants, code, data, and they just wanted to do that layout. So to make that layout happen, this is the load instruction to use for that. And the question is, why do we use file size instead of memory size? Because it has an initial value, I assume that probably they had to store that value. Maybe the value is zeros, in which case using the mem size would make sense. I think you don't get a different answer if you use the mem size. A question related to mem size. Why on question one did I not include the mem size and the size on disk? Because the file size is all we load from disk. If the mem size is bigger, we just fill it with zeros. So one way you can think about this process is loading the executable is we go to each load instruction, we allocate mem size bytes of memory at this location and copy file size bytes into it. So only the amount we copy needs to actually be in the file. Okay, so with question one, I talked about these holes here, and you might say, why are these holes here? And this has to do with how Linux and most other OSs manage memory. That they typically manage memory in units called pages to deal with a hardware feature called virtual memory that you'll learn a lot about if you take operating systems and or computer architecture. And on 64-bit x86, pages are 4,096 bytes, and the OS is going to work in units of these. And this means that loads actually need to work in pages, even though the sizes in these headers are specified in bytes and the offsets are specified in bytes. In particular, on Linux, the offset needs to be a multiple of the page size. And that's why, this is 1000, because that's a multiple of 4096. 1000 hex is 4096 in decimal. And that's why this is a round number, and so on. Because the offsets, I guess, are it's more convenient if they are, and something weird has to happen for this. Offsets, I guess, must is the wrong word. Typically, multiple of page size, but most importantly, the size is rounded up to a whole number of pages when we load. So we can see that example here. As far as what happens, I guess the rounding happens in an unexpected way here, is that this is, so I took this program and ran it, and I looked at what was actually in memory. And we can see that, you know, the program header, it asked for less than 4,096 bytes. Well, you actually got a 4,096 bytes because that's the unit that is loaded. That can be allocated. And similarly, these asked for less than a whole number of pages. They got rounded up when they actually got loaded. And Linux did something weird here, where you can see that this location here got rounded down. And it did something weird with maybe down the first part got mapped as read-only and the rest as read-write, and it split up these bytes into different sections. But it still totals up to that size. But you can see everything is done in these units of whole pages, so we have this rounding that happens. Okay. So that was going through sort of standard executables. And what I've shown you here are statically linked executables. So I've shown you just loading everything and running it, but a lot of executables don't work that way. So in particular, sort of an assumption here is that this includes all the library code we need, that we don't need to like load a copy of printf separately. But very commonly, in fact, most commonly, executables you see on Linux and most OSs will have the library code loaded from other files. And we'll talk about how that works next time. And also, the code is loaded at a fixed address instead of that address being changeable. This is also less common today. It used to be, you know, the case, but it's less common. So we'll look at how these two things change those headers next time. But first, sort of an interlude into thinking about Vienna again. So, so Vienna, like, put things in the end of executables, just searching for executables. And we mentioned that this sort of option is not going to actually work so well on modern systems. So we're going to look at other places we can put executable code. And one thing we're going to think about in doing this is sort of avoiding detection. So Vienna is not very subtle as far as being detectable if we look at executable code. And there's a bunch of options we're going to have, some of which are even less subtle than Vienna, and some of which are very subtle. We're going to start looking at these. We'll talk about the first couple, because they're going to be short, and next time we'll look at some more interesting ones. So Vienna, it seemed like the simplest way of having a virus, something that replicates itself and changes normal, you know, innocent programs to be malicious, you know, in some subtle way. But there's an even simpler way, which is just replace it. So just take our original program, replace it with a copy of the virus. And you might say, wait a moment. So in Vienna, they were going through all this effort so that a normal user wouldn't notice what was going on. Like, would anyone really do this clearly inferior strategy? And, well, someone has. So in 2000, the I Love You Worm, which was very impactful and spread via email, worm, it used this strategy. So it wasn't really a virus because it wasn't changing the other files, but it was replacing them with copies of itself. And needless to say, this was very impactful and perhaps meant that it had a much shorter lifespan because, well, this was really disruptive. It wasn't like Vienna where, you know, you might not notice it for a while. Now, someone's pointing out, well, you know, we don't have to be so disruptive. Like, why don't we just take the original executable and put it somewhere and then, you know, replace the executable but run that copy we put somewhere. And this is a real strategy that some viruses have used. And there's a version of it which is a little more subtle than putting it somewhere, which is that you replace the original executable with your virus code and then the original executable, and you like copy the original executable somewhere at the end of your virus. Your end of your virus just makes a copy of this and runs it. So that is something people do. And the advantage of this strategy over Vienna is that as far as the effort that the virus author went to, this is so much easier than all that machine code manipulation in Vienna. And also so much easier than what you'd have to do to make Vienna work with a modern executable format like ELF. And that's what we're going to talk about next time. So we saw the Vienna strategy, which was, you know, append the executable. But, you know, if we want to do that in something like the ELF executable format, know, that's not actually going to work because, you know, this extra stuff here won't be loaded. So we'll talk about what that fix up is next time and some of these sort of more subtle strategies, some ways which are going to be less easy to detect than what Vienna did and more of a concern if you're writing antivirus software. Like, how do you look for things where the file size isn't changing? But to think about that first, we're going to think about what are viruses going to do if they infect without, like, giving some telltale sign like that. That's where I'll leave off for today. We'll take questions before I sign off.
Why did it run down back when it was loading and it loaded the fourth segment and it rounded down the memory? Did it just calculate that the previous segment was not going to overrun into the 40, whatever it was, 38B?
So you're saying here, why did it round this down?
Down, yeah.
So I'm not sure what the exact logic is, but the way the memory allocation works is that you can't allocate this byte without allocating this one.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's just not possible in the hardware.
Yeah.
So the only way of allocating this is to allocate that. I'm not sure why it was mapped read-only. This is probably mapped read-only because of probably, I'm not sure, though. There's probably some other instructions saying to make this read-only, and it could be the case that it becomes read-write later on under some circumstances.
Okay. Thank you.
So a question is, I mentioned Vienna, like, looking for infected files. Like, is there something that made it search? So the way Vienna worked is that every time you ran an infected executable, Vienna would run first. And that was the only time it would run. And, you know, if you start executables a lot, that's a pretty effective strategy, you know, for the virus. But you might think that maybe a virus would want to run more often. There are ways we'll talk about which might end up doing that. I'm going to...